Game on 2FM. With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Thanks to Jenny Green for her entertainment all afternoon. It's now the evening of Tuesday, the 23rd of March.
Coming up on Game On tonight, Tony O'Donoghue brings us the latest from the Republic of Ireland camp ahead of tomorrow's big game in Serbia.
There they are, the champions, Shamrock Rovers. They've broken their own record, their 18th title, their first since 2011, and the good times are back in Tala.
And as always, we broaden our view of European football with Mark Langdon.
We ask Gary Murphy if Rory McIlroy can re-find his form in time for the US Masters.
And we talk to paracyclist Martin Gordon and his pilot Eamon Byrne ahead of their campaign The Next Level.
You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Well, as I'm sure you figured out there, myself and Dunica were waiting for Stings and never played, and Marie just bailed us out. But anyway, moving swiftly on. Kildare GAA stood up to Croke Park and said it was Newbridge or nowhere. Dunners, the Lions are standing up. It's South Africa or nowhere by the sounds of it.
Yeah, well, it's good to hear, Ruby. The British and Irish Lions today confirmed they intend to tour South Africa for the summer as originally planned. So there was talks, like we discussed many times, of being in Australia or maybe in the UK and to include Ireland. But they said today that they will tour as planned. There is no itinerary yet, and I think it will be a bit of a logistical nightmare trying to get organised, but something feels right about it. You know my views on the Lions and how I feel they're a touring party. I would love to see this happen, but I question how difficult it's going to be.
Donegal, how many people are you talking in total?
You're at least chatting, I would think. Everyone thought Clive Woodward was crazy bringing 35 players. What went out the last time? 42. I think you'd easily need that, around 46. And that's just players.
That's what I meant. So tease it out, 46 then.
Yeah.
Management, coaches, backroom staff. What's the number? What number are you looking at?
Ooh, it's a big staffing. I'll be honest with you. I'm not too sure the number, but you'd be in around kind of 120, would you? In around that, just with... It's amazing now, even social media teams, people that are... Like, I toured in 2005 and there was a group that went ahead everywhere we went. So basically they got hotel ready for your arrival. You never actually met them, but they were a week ahead of you. So there is teams within it. So it'll be interesting. I know your point, though. I would think it's about in around the 100 mark of people touring. But the big interest, Ruby, is the fans. And I can promise you, Welsh people saved for 4 years to go on Lions tours. This is the pinnacle of their summer holidays, heading on these things. I don't think we're going to see that.
There's a fair chance they'll be going first class to the next one in 8 years' time then. They'll have that much money saved.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a bad call. There was other good news in rugby today. Adam Griggs named his squad. So we have five new cap players. Unfortunately, it's a 35-man squad. We're unfortunate to lose kind of such experience. Lursa Muldoon, Kira Coney and Edel McMahon are all out through injury. But there is five new caps in the squad, which is good to see. And an awful lot of them coming in from sevens. So Adam Griggs has a history with using the sevens programme. But it'll be interesting to see how these go, because they will be able to whip the ball around the place.
Amy Lee Murphy Crowe was top try scorer in 2019 and in the team of the tournament. I think so many of her clips have gone viral. She's absolutely brilliant. But Stacey Flood is another one who I actually played Gaelic football with before. Yeah, she was obviously a lot younger than me, but it was down in Clonagael, and her sister Kim Flood as well, who was a 15s player. Stacey was with the seven, so it's great to see her now make the transition to 15s, and I'd say she's going to do absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, and it's a brilliant thing. New blood within the squad, obviously 35 important games coming up, and the brilliant news is that they'll all be covered on RTE, so that is exciting. Like we always talk about, it's important to see these matches, and it'll all come to a head on a Super Saturday, the 24th of April. Hopefully we'll see the Irish girls go a little bit further on the Six Nations.
Yeah, it's been a bit of a long road for them, like only finding out their fixtures today. So I think there was probably a lot of frustration from fans just wondering and hoping when it was when they were going to be on and when they could start planning their weekends and what they're going to be watching. So it is brilliant to actually see them get their fixtures. Now, the Republic of Ireland, there is a huge match coming up tomorrow, which is going to be live on Game On, which is very exciting to have it. Stephen Kenny's big World Cup qualifier opening game against Serbia. He had a press conference today, and Tony O'Donoghue was there, RTÉ's soccer correspondent. Tony, how are you?
I'm fine. Well, I wasn't there, really. I was at home watching it on a laptop.
No one's there anymore, Tony.
Virtually, Tony.
I know, yeah. Actually, it was exciting, though. I did get a camera was sent to my house to take a shot of me watching my laptop, talking to Seamus Coleman for an exclusive interview for the programme before the programme tomorrow. And where I'm broadcasting to you from now is our little box room. And when Cormac Downes arrived with his tripod and his light, and he went, Jesus, we can't do it here. So we had to go downstairs to the kitchen. Sarah wasn't too happy when she heard that, because she went, what? I haven't cleaned up, but I don't think you'll see much of the kitchen. You won't see much of me either, because Seamus was his usual brilliant self, very honest. I mean, he's a perfect captain, isn't he? I mean, I think it's unthinkable that he won't start the game. He's in good form. He's diplomatic. He's experienced. He's so proud to be Irish. And with a lot of such young and new faces in the squad, I think he's the perfect man to lead us into this campaign. And hopefully, we're not even talking about this because there's been so much doom and gloom, hopefully to lead us to a World Cup finals in Qatar.
That would be amazing, Tony. But when you look at it, Seamus Coleman fighting for a spot against Matt Doherty, is there any way Stephen Kenny can get the two of them into the team? I mean, we're so down so much on players.
Yeah,
can he accommodate both?
He could, and I think he probably will, but it does mean probably changing his philosophy to an extent, and, you know, needs must, and maybe he'll have to do that. But then how much will he change it? He's trying to inculcate a new philosophy. It hasn't gone very well so far. There's been plenty of extenuating circumstances, you might say, but other people would call that excuses. There's a terrific article by Roy Curtis in The Independent Online at the moment, where he sort of puts the boot in a bit. And, Roy's a terrific writer. He's also fair. I think he did point out in the article that, you know, Stephen Kenny is a patently decent man with a brave idealistic vision of how he wants to play. But, you know, there have been lots of reasons, COVID not least, injuries, scandals, Wembley, motivational video issues. But, you know, so far, as Roy points out in his article, we've had 11 largely clueless hours, he said. We've crashed and burned. We've been dismal. He calls it a carnival of mediocrity. Now, that's a bit strong for me. But, you know, it's hard to be positive when you look at what we've done so far. I think Stephen Kenny, the best thing we can do as journalists and as supporters is to judge him as we would any other manager. And so Jack Charlton made it to World Cup finals and the European Championships, of course. And we also saw that Mick McCarthy led us to a tournament, the World Cup final. The same can be said of Trapattoni in 2012 and Martin O'Neill and Roy Keane. So those are the standards that Stephen Kenny needs to be judged against as well. And, you know, yes, it's a time of transition. Yes, we need a lot going for us. He may have to, you know, put his principles up to the wall and say, we need a result in Serbia. We need to try and get Matt Doherty into the team. We need Seamus Coleman to be in the team. There's lots and lots for him to think about between now and kickoff tomorrow. They're training later this evening in the match stadium. So they did the media earlier than usual this morning. And we can just keep the fingers crossed. So far, we're COVID-free, which is great. We managed to get there without any more drama, losing any more players for whatever reason. And we just hope tonight that they're all okay as well. Because the last time Seamus Coleman was involved was the night of Wembley Gate, the night before the match against England, when that motivational video was shown. And he suffered an injury in training that night and wasn't involved. So it's been a long time since we've had the opportunity to be led by Seamus Coleman. And hopefully, as I say, he can lead us to the promised land.
Well, let's hear from Stephen Kenny and Seamus Coleman from earlier today.
Yeah, no, I clearly have my mind made up how I want to approach it. I think there's instructions will be clear. We trained tonight in the stadium. We're looking forward to that. It was great to have Manchester City's facilities yesterday, that we could meet so quickly, because for some of them it was match day plus one, match day plus two. You know, you had to modify the training, etc. But you're right, everyone's reported fit. All the COVID tests have been negative. you know, certainly looking forward to training tonight and then making sure we're ready for the game tomorrow. It's hugely exciting at the start of a campaign like this for everyone. So we're looking forward to the game.
As players, I suppose you come in and you're not looking too much at what the 11 will be. You're kind of focusing on yourself and letting the manager and the coaching team decide the rest of it. But we do have a strong squad. We've got players in here hungry to do well and happy to be here for their country. So it's a tough game for us, but like always, we will give it our all.
Tony, I watched the press conference live today when it went out, and I couldn't but feel that there was a sense it was an opportunity to put the past behind them for Stephen especially. He seemed quite relaxed and almost excited about what was to come.
Against that as well, I think a good start in this group will change the mood music completely around the Ireland squad. There has been, you know, he has been incredibly unfortunate and there's been so many things have gone on around it, but there is an opportunity to blow all the doom away. Yeah, on paper I'd have to say Serbia are a better side than us. They have better individual players, they're playing at home, but some of that advantage is nullified a bit. The stadium is known to be one of the more intimidating venues in world football. It really is old fashioned, and the fans were very, you know, they're the ultras, they're the hardcore, but of course they won't be there tomorrow. So, you know, that gives our inexperienced players, you know, maybe a little lift. These are only small things, but they can all be inches. They can all be little advantages. And, you know, there's going to be players, he has choices to make, but if it's the likes of Jason Knight in midfield at 20 years of age, or Josh Cullen, who's playing for Anderlecht and doing very well at 24, or if Aaron Connolly is deemed fit enough, although he said he reckoned he's a little bit undercooked, but he's like 21 years of age, or Darrell Shea, 21 years of age. Like, we've kind of skipped a generation. We haven't had enough new players coming through. That's been a fault in Irish football, you know, from the ground up. So, yeah, it is a period of transition. And, you know, Serbia, they've got a new manager and they'll be hoping for a bounce, but they haven't had a brilliant time. They've only won one of their last six games. They went out in a Euro playoff to Scotland and are really disappointed with that. And they've got to play Ireland, then they've got to play Portugal, then they've got to play Azerbaijan. If it goes badly for them, they could be out of contention in this group in a week's time. It's incredible. I mean, you know, the World Cup has taken ages to come around, but now it feels almost like a sprint, you know, from March to the middle of November, and the games will come through. So we have the two games, Luxembourg on Saturday, after this. If we can get any result at all in Serbia, if we can get a win in Serbia, follow that up with a win against Luxembourg, that changes everything.
Tony, they've only won 1-6. We haven't scored a goal in 7. Do we need to manage our expectations a little bit here, like, and hope for the 4 points out of the two matches?
Yeah, I think that would be a realistic aim. Yeah, I hope I'm not bigging it up too much. I do feel, Steve, as in response to Marie's question, that Stephen, you know, seemed calmer, and I think that there is a change there. But no, you know, realistically, a team that. Players who haven't been playing regularly, including the goalkeepers, who haven't been playing first team football, who are only coming back from injury, you know, and missing key men like Darren Randolph, you know, who played the last 38 consecutive competitive games, or John Egan, who Stephen Kenny said was, you know, key to his, you know, defensive mentality. Or James McCarthy, or Conor Hourihan, who would seem to have found form having gone from Aston Villa to Swansea, and then to get injured as well. So, yeah, Serbia is a tough opponent, but it's, you know, I think there's a lot of pressure on them as the home side, and yeah, I definitely would be hopeful. I have a funny feeling about this one. You know, I sometimes get like that, and I do think that something positive is on the horizon.
He was obviously guarded about his team selection today, and he was asked all the key points, and it's kind of almost trying to discern really what he meant by of what he said. It was clear that Mark Travers is going to start. He said that Aaron Connolly and James McLean both undercooked. He did mention Callum Robinson hitting the back of the net a couple of times. I noticed that as well, and that Shane Duffy had never let his country down. Who would you think he's going to be leaning towards, just given what he was saying today and the suggestions that he was making? Who's going to be his starting 11, Tony?
Yeah, the Shane Duffy one is such a conundrum. I mean, he pointed out himself that nobody has been dissected more in a way than Shane Duffy and his move. And Seamus Coleman talked about this as well. I mean, Duffy is a warrior, has always been for Ireland, and he's our most potent scoring threat, perhaps unfortunately. But, you know, he lost his father last summer. His father was a very young man, a fabulous supporter of Shane in his career. Oh, I remember meeting him when, you know, when Shane had that terrible injury that he nearly lost his own life. And he was rushed to hospital from Malahide. Such a lovely family, the Duffys. And so to lose his dad at such a young age, and then the way the football calendar is, and like the boys will know this from professional sport, it's cruel. You know, the time goes on. He didn't have time to really process that, I think, or to mourn properly. He was back at Brighton and then up to Scotland for his transfer to his loan move to Celtic, which clearly hasn't worked out for him. He was thinking that he was going to get more game time. He'd be in a team which would have a lot more of the ball. He'd be playing in Europe. And remember, for those games with Ireland, he played all the games and he was out of sorts physically, as well as whatever he was feeling emotionally. And I think he's had a tough time. So there's a big call. Do you talk to him and see, are you okay, big man? Are you ready for it? And can form just be recreated like that? Or do you say, no, I'll rest him and I'll go with a younger man? I've a sense, because of Shane's big character, that he'll want to play. Maybe he'll want to play for his dad and for his country. And I think he might go in this one with, because again, we're going to be obviously conceding or at least defending a lot, hopefully not conceding a lot, and just to get a more experienced defensive partnership, because I think he'll then line up alongside Kieran Clarke. But that's a big call for Stephen Kenny to make. I think Coleman has to play. I think he's too valuable to Ireland, and again, his experience, I think he's a better defender than Matt Doherty, and I think Enda Stevens is a shoe-in on the other side at left back. So then you've got to decide who's going to anchor your midfield. I think he's been very keen on Jason Knight. You know, he's playing at Derby County. He's only 20 years of age. Wayne Rooney made him captain, and I think we could see him starting in the air. It's a big responsibility, but I think he's got the engine and the ability to do it. And I think he's gone to watch Stephen Kenny's gone to watch Josh Cullen a lot when he was at Charlton, and he's watched a lot of him at Anderlecht. So I think he might play, but I think he'd probably play Jeff Hendrick for his experience in the big games. And Hendrick did score the last time we played in Serbia after 3 minutes. That's a game we went ahead early, and as per usual with Ireland, we then, you know, kind of frightened into our shell and left Serbia back into it. And then Alan Brown, but up front, we, you know, pick a coin, any coin. I mean, Robinson, what he said about Robinson and Connolly was hitting the back of the net tonight in the stadium. He says getting into the stadium and literally hitting the back of the net tonight in training will be good for them, and I guess it probably will, but the important thing is to do it tomorrow.
Absolutely. Tony O'Donoghue, thanks so much for joining us. And just a reminder as well, we will be carrying live commentary of that game here on 2FM tomorrow.
With Green Fern. Naturally good food packed with protein. Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now, before we get to European football with Mark Langdon, Ruby, just a quick note on honeysuckle. There is a story there today that honeysuckle might be heading towards Punchestown, according to Henry de Bromhead.
Yeah, that would be the obvious place for it to go, Marie. The alternative could have been Aintree, but I think she was highly unlikely to travel to Liverpool in 3 weeks' time, so she'll head back to Punchestown on the Friday for the Irish Champion Hurdle, where it'll be a different thing for her. She'll be a sharper, faster track, and I think the speedsters that finish behind her in Cheltenham will fancy another crack at her there.
Do horses need recovery like athletes do?
Yeah, in an ideal world, you would be looking at, in early in the season, you'd be hoping to run every 4 weeks as they would get fitter and progress through the season, and on their drier spring ground, you could turn them around in 3 weeks and maybe 2 weeks. But yeah, they do need recovery time like all athletes, Dunica.
Shishkin, Ruby, off to Aintree. Is that the next spot for
Shishkin? Yeah, but him being trained in the UK, that would look the ideal spot for him to go straight from Cheltenham to Aintree, whereas the Irish horses would be more inclined to go to Punchestown. Well, it could be an unbelievable punches down because the programme is slightly different. So you could have Alaho clashing with Put the Kettle On and Shaq and Pourchois in the 2 mile race because there isn't a 2.5 mile chase for him. And the same goes for the novice chasers. NY Allen went 2.5 in Cheltenham. He would have to come back to the 2 mile in Punchestown maybe to take on Enner Grameen or go out to 3 miles and take on Monkfish. So different programme could create some brilliant clashes at Punchestown at the end of April.
Okay, sounds good. Right, let's get back to the football because we do have a lot to get through, and it's going to start with that massive game tomorrow against Serbia for the Republic of Ireland. Mark Langdon from the Racing Post joins us. Mark, we went through the Ireland team there with Tony O'Donoghue, but we didn't get to touch too much on the Serbian team. We know that they have a new manager in Dragan Stojkovic and that he has come out and said that they're going to go out, try and attack, not sit back with 10 men and grind it out. But do they have the players for that?
I think they do. I think that they're probably been big underachievers in recent years, really, Serbia. And there's Luka Milivojevic of Crystal Palace, who quit the national team after being dropped for this squad, alluded to the fact that it hasn't been a particularly good dressing room in recent years. And anyone's guess, really, as to whether Stojkovic, who was a brilliant player in his day, a real sort of hero of that Yugoslav national team that reached the quarterfinals of the World Cup at Italia 90, were beaten by Maradona's Argentina on penalties, whether he can sort of just lift the spirits. Because if you look at the players, man for man, particularly in midfield, Dusan Tadic, the captain, what, you know, expected to be the playmaker, has had a brilliant couple of years with Ajax. Milinkovic Savic of Lazio, when he eventually leaves them, is going to go for a lot of money and was being spoken about as a potential Real Madrid player not that long ago. So they've definitely got the talent to be better than they've shown in recent times. But Ireland fans will, you know, remember playing Serbia, and they haven't really shown that ability in recent years. So a bit of a shot in the dark as to what Serbia turns up, but they've definitely got talent. And, you know, up front, Mitrovic hasn't had a very good season for Fulham, nor has Luka Jovic at Real Madrid, but Vlahovic at Fiorentina has just started to show some glimpses of potential there. So he might get a run out and, you know, could actually be the more dangerous of the three, despite being probably less heralded than the other two.
Mark, in soccer terms, the home nations, they're all in action either Wednesday night or Thursday night. Wales are in Belgium. That's going to be a big ask for them, the top ranked team in the world.
Yeah, it is. I mean, in their sort of pomp, when they were riding high under Chris Coleman, they got a brilliant result against Belgium. But I wouldn't have thought that it was likely this time around. The national team's already been hurt, really, by Ben Davis, his injury. He's had to withdraw. Gareth Bale has only shown little bits and bobs of his best form at Tottenham. Aaron Ramsey's not been particularly good for Juventus. So you go round and thinking, yeah, the real big players for Wales haven't shown up in recent times, particularly at club level, and it's the complete opposite for Belgium. So many talented players. Dries Mertens scored twice for Napoli at the weekend. Lukaku has recovered from COVID, all the viral, missed out for Tottenham, but it's just getting back to fitness as well. Kevin De Bruyne at Manchester City. This is a team of world-class talent all over the pitch, and I think Wales will probably be looking to get second spot in this group, which would be enough for the playoffs. And, you know, it could be that the games against the Czechs are the real important ones for Wales in this group, and I don't expect too much against Belgium.
On Thursday evening, Northern Ireland will travel to Italy to face the Italians. Would they be in a similar boat, hoping for a draw?
Yeah, I think they will. I mean, Italy have been on a really good run under Roberto Mancini. They were a team that I think fancied their chances of going well at the European Championship last summer. In fact, the fact that it's been put back a year could be to the benefit of this Italian national team, because they've got a lot of young players, and maybe it was a year too soon for some of them, but they've been able to develop, and Mancini picks a massive squad every time. There's sort of 30-odd players in the squad. He sort of struggles to narrow it down and whittle it down to a more sensible number. Northern Ireland, a plucky, I don't want to mean to be too disrespectful, and have shown that they're not the worst underdogs in the world. You know, they've been very battling and hard to break down and all of those kind of things that have been associated with Northern Ireland in the last few years. But ultimately, there's quite a big class difference between Italy and Northern Ireland. And a bit like Wales, I think Northern Ireland's best chance of qualifying probably is to finish second ahead of the Swiss, who are better than Northern Ireland, but are a team that you can beat, whereas I think Italy could be a step too far.
Speaking of Wales, Gareth Bale, turns out, is not going to be sticking with Spurs for the long term.
No, he said today that he's going back to Real Madrid. That might be news to Real Madrid at the end of the summer of this sort of season. He wants to, he'll just sit on the bench if he does go back to Real Madrid. I think this is probably just a long, drawn-out game, really, where Bale is threatening Real Madrid that he's coming back and, And quite rightly,
he's coming back. It's so bad, isn't it?
but for somebody that's on, it varies to what you hear in reports. It's about $500,000 a week. I mean, why is he going to leave Real Madrid? Unless he gets his payoff. So he's threatening Real Madrid in that way. I would be surprised if he were to come back to Tottenham if Jose Mourinho was still the manager. If there was another manager, maybe it would be different. But I don't think Gareth Bale, in saying that he's going back to Real Madrid, I don't know if he's been completely honest about the fact that that's exactly where he's going to play his football next season. The contract with Spurs is only until the end of the year, so it's obvious that he's going back, but Real Madrid don't want him and they don't want to pay his wages and will do quite a lot to get rid of him.
Speaking of La Liga, I suppose you're looking at the Atletico Bilbao match at the weekend with the drone and the flag protesting against the Euro 2020 matches that are going to be played there, or 2021 matches as they are now in the Basque region. Spain are due to play all their games there. It's a quite contentious issue.
Oh, it really is, yes. Yeah. So this was a Basque derby at the weekend between Athletic Bilbao and Eibar. Not the biggest of Basque derbies, that would be Athletic against Real Sociedad, but still one where there's sort of local pride at stake in the game. And as you say, Ruby, a drone landed on the pitch. And Spain have not played in the Basque region since the 1960s. And there are sort of definitely some people in the Basque country that would like it to remain that way, and that there's been some off-field, some bombings in the past, where it's really turned quite ugly, between these separatists that really consider themselves not part of Spain, and the Basque country should be recognised as its own country. So it is a contentious issue for Spain to go and play their home games there. Whether, of course, Bilbao is one of the cities that keeps its place, we don't yet know, but certainly there are some people that don't want the Spanish national team to play in the Basque region. And Laporta, the Barcelona president or incoming president, was asked the same thing about whether he would like the Spanish national team to play in the Catalan capital, and he was pretty adamant that that wouldn't happen either, and Spain tend to play most of their games in Madrid, or they sometimes go to Seville.
Mark, there was a lot of excitement in the world of football earlier today when news started to break that Xabi Alonso could possibly be getting the Mönchengladbach job. It doesn't seem to be the case. He is the manager of the Sociedad B team. Is he doing enough to possibly get a big job soon?
Yeah, he is, absolutely. They're top of their regional group, the B team, and Barcelona B was where Guardiola made his name, Zinedine Zidane made his name with Real Madrid B. It was very funny because Kicker, the German magazine, very respected yesterday, was suggesting that he was kind of on the verge of getting the job, and that they've now reporting today that maybe that's not the case and they jumped the gun somewhat. But I would say that Xabi Alonso is probably sort of the most exciting name around for those that haven't got their teeth cut into a proper managerial job. There was a lot of excitement in the Premier League with that kind of generation of Gerrard and Lampard and Rooney, and all of them have now made at least their first steps onto the way. And Xabi Alonso, somebody that has worked with some you know, all of the greats, basically, you know, Mourinho in his pomp, Pep Guardiola. There was the tactics, I suppose, of Rafa Benitez as well. He's won the World Cup with Del Bosque. So he kind of takes bits of everyone. You know, not many people that have played for Mourinho and Guardiola. It seems to be, you know, Mourinho has his disciples and Guardiola has his. And yet Xabi Alonso is one that has managed to kind of cross that divide and take some of what made Mourinho special, as well as sort of all the Pep Guardiola possession based you know, process and that whole approach to the game. So yeah, I think it's very exciting that Xabi Alonso will soon enough get a job at a big European club. He speaks German as well, so I think that it would have made sense, really. I think Gladbach would have been the perfect first step for him. Maybe something else is on the horizon for him, but definitely an exciting name and one to watch, I would say, in the next 12 months, Xabi Alonso to get a job and sort of see if he can. There's a lot of talk and a lot of hype around Xabi Alonso. Let's see if he lives up to it. I certainly hope that he does.
Looking at Marie on FaceTime here, you get the feeling she's a massive Xabi Alonso fan. But Erling Haaland scored twice at the weekend for Dortmund, and he's been linked to loads of clubs, Mark. But I read earlier that Danny Ings looks set to replace Sergio Aguero at Man City. Could that be possible?
Yeah, I've read that as well. I also saw a follow-up report that said Man City fans would prefer Haaland instead of Danny Ings, which isn't a surprise to anyone. Danny Ings would be a very cheap signing for somebody. He's sort of not signed his new contract at Southampton. He was at Liverpool previously. I think he would accept his position as not being a first choice striker and, you know, part of that City rotation, or if he went to another of the big six. I don't think his body necessarily can allow him to play every week anyway. He seems to break down with injuries quite often. So I think there will be a certain amount of sense to that kind of move, but I would also imagine that at some stage Man City will want to go out and get themselves a superstar in those four positions. Haaland wouldn't be a natural fit because I think Pep Guardiola prefers more nimble strikers and ones that can drop into midfield, and Haaland would be kind of different to anything he's had previously. But as you mentioned there, those two goals again at the weekend got Dortmund out of a bad spot in the draw against Cologne. He just scores so many different types of goals. He can sort of get the tap-ins, he can bully defenders. He's just on a rapid rise and seems to be showing no signs of slowing down. He's got a bit of arrogance about him as well, which a lot of people seem to like, and he's a terrible, terrible loser, but quite often the best sportsmen are, I suppose.
I think Ings is the type of player that if you're playing fantasy football and you have a few pounds left over but you don't have enough to buy a really big striker, that you buy him. Mark Langdon, thanks so much for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern, a 100% natural range of cooked chicken, turkey and beef. Natural protein your way.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. We're going to go to golf next, and Gary Murphy is joining us on the line. Gary, Rory McIlroy has enlisted renowned coach Peter Cohen on an official basis as he bids to rediscover his form ahead of the Masters. A step in the right direction?
Time will tell, Ruby. It's an interesting one. Pete Cohen is a famous coach. He's worked with a lot of top players. I guess Brooks Koepka is probably his main guy now, having left Claude Harmon. Pete's been around the game for 100 years. Is he going to suit McIlroy? It'll be interesting. I'll kind of. I personally don't think it will work out. The changes that Rory needs to make, you know, I don't think he needs massive reconstruction, golf or swing wise. The thing with Pete Cohen is he kind of has a set way of how he sees the game. I've actually worked with Pete in my time on tour. Whether he can communicate that to Rory and it works is going to be a very interesting space the next couple of weeks. I wouldn't be surprised to see him get an early bounce, but long term, I'd have question marks over it, really.
So, Gary, what's his process? Like, what's he going to do with Rory over the next few weeks?
I think most of the work would probably be done initially in a conversation of where Rory sees his game, where Pete sees Rory's game, what they need to work on. I think the dogs in the street know that he needs to improve his wedge game. That's probably Pete Cowan's best department. He's a short game specialist. My only worry would be if they work on a short game to improve that and then filter it into the long game. You know, how that message is going to get translated, how it's interpreted. Rory has had the same coach since he's 8 years of age, which I think is phenomenal. He's been out on tour since 07 and just had one guy. I think the career McIlroy is going to have, it would be highly unusual for him to just have one coach his whole life. Michael Bannon's done an amazing job of not doing a whole lot, which in itself is great coaching. And I guess just where he's at, no more in his at his age or in his life, it's probably maybe time to, you know, try something new and see if he can reignite where he's at the moment. The only thing worrying me was they did a bit of work, I think, before the TPC, and Rory shot a lot. He's not a guy who shoots 79 very often, once every 4 or 5 years type of thing. So whether that was just trying to bed in something new, I think it'd be folly for Pete Cowan to, you know, try to dramatically change things. Dermot Gallis had a great piece in the Indo on Sunday, you know, was saying that his mindset is something that needs to be altered. Now, whether that can be altered if he feels happy physically, that's the great question in golf. You know, is it a physical change to create a psychological change? Time will tell. It's very interesting. I mean, Cowan's a renowned coach. Just because you've had success with other players doesn't necessarily mean it'll work for McIlroy. But I think something probably had to change. It's no blot on Michael Bannon. He's done an amazing job at Rory. But it's going to be a very interesting space to see if it all works out.
Now, Rory had alluded to the fact that he'd altered his swing in an attempt to get more length to counteract what Bryson was doing. But has Rory just kind of forgot to do the simple things? Is it as easy as that for him? Just go back to his own game?
I think with every golfer, you know, just trying to do the simple things well should be everybody's mantra. But when you see Bryson coming out last year and performing the way he did, and McIlroy already has a, you know, very powerful golf game, very powerful action, and I guess, you know, golfers are like sheep. I keep saying that, you know, if one guy has success doing something, it's kind of human nature to give it a go. Rory, when he came out on tour first, was quite a slight young fella and transformed his body physically probably after his first couple of years on tour. And then went, you know, he's very athletic now and very strong and gets everything out of what he has. But the big thing with DeChambeau is DeChambeau, you know, he won that US Open with phenomenal putting. I think Rory is ahead of him in the driving stats, so... he's working with Brad Faxon on his putting. That's probably still his Achilles heel. Come a Sunday, major time in recent times. But it's just McIlroy's box office. You know, and any time there's a change, everyone wants to know about it. And the great thing about him is he's going to tell us about it. So we'll get a good insight into how it's going to work. But, I think he just got a little bit caught up in the fact that he's a, like Dustin Johnson did the same thing, but he identified it a little bit quicker. So there's no doubt everyone is chasing speed as a quick fix to maybe some other issues in other parts of the game.
So Gary, if you're like looking at Rory with critical eye, and particularly his swing, are you seeing things that he can improve on, or like is he overthinking things?
I think, referring back to Dermot Gallis' piece as well, if you watch Rory on a range hit a golf ball, you just think, oh, I'll take up this game, this looks really easy. Physically, he's sensational to hit a ball, but going from the range to a golf course in the white heat of battle is all about trust. He does historically like to move the ball predominantly from right to left. He's tried to change that a little bit with the short irons, to try hold the ball off a little more. I don't think that suits him. I think it's very hard when you're under extreme pressure to go away from your instinct. And whether Pete's going to work on that and just try get Rory to be the best version of himself rather than Pete Cowan trying to implement his swing philosophy into Rory's swing, that's where things could get a little complicated, I think. But I would certainly say for McIlroy to just have sound fundamentals is all he needs. I mean, he's got a naturally gifted golf swing, which has, you know, been grooved and narrowed and tightened a little bit over the years, but it's tiny, tiny margins. If they start looking down deep holes, looking for something small, you can easily fall into serious booby traps. And I would hate to see that happen, because he's just going to hit landmines, which he doesn't need to hit. I think clarity of thought and a good vibe is as important as anything else for McIlroy.
Obviously, Rory had last weekend off. He's on again next weekend, which we'll get to in a minute. But the Honda Classic, Matt Jones, he just blew them away in the first round.
He did, yep, he did. He did it the hardest way he can do it. He went out from the front, a bit like Florin Porter in Cheltenham, really.
Just catch me if you can.
Yeah, went out in front and, you know, catch me if you can. And everyone said after the first round that 9-under would win it. I know he got to 12-under, but 9-under would have won that golf tournament. And just tells you how tough that course is. He's a quality player, Matt Jones. The last 24 weeks in the PGA Tour, we've had 24 different winners. So it just goes to show the depth of talent out there. Anyone can win on a given week if they get in the right headspace and trust themselves. He's a two-time Australian Open champion. He's won the Houston Open. He's been on tour for a long time. So he's a quality player. He just got everything right last week, and he didn't fear it coming down the stretch. And it was a proper win because he's, you know, a normal enough golfer in the scheme of things. He's not a new modern power player, but he just had great ball control and aligned with good putting. Scrambled really well on Saturday when he had to, and then found that space on Sunday to hit a lot of greens and take the pressure off the edge in his game, and it was good to see.
What happened to Shane Lowry then, Gary, after such a promising start?
I think he kind of hit the skids a bit on Saturday. He had a poor back nine, probably trying to force it a bit. And then Sunday was all about a start. Like, he needed to get off to a good start. He didn't. You're just back in that headspace of, I wouldn't say here we go again, but, you know, he had a chance to win on Saturday. I think that's where he needs to draw the positives. Getting yourself up there is where you learn a lot, and hopefully he will have learned a lot from last weekend. I just think he got in his own way, maybe forcing a bit on Saturday, got off to a poor start Sunday, and he's trying to retrieve it, and it didn't happen. But plus, he had a big week the previous week, and that does take it out of you. He did go to Augusta Monday, Tuesday to prep, so maybe he just ran out a bit of steam come the weekend. But it's a massive week for Lowry this week. He did a lot of good at the Players to get himself back in some sort of Ryder Cup talk, and, you know, with a guaranteed check this week. It's a match play event. He's done well in this in the past. Even a decent enough group. So he's got a good chance to shine again this week.
He's in with John Rahn, Ryan Palmer and Sebastian Munoz. You say he's in a decent enough group. It's a strange format. He doesn't play against John Rahm until 4 p.m. on Thursday. What does he have to win? Two rounds to progress, or does he have to beat all three?
Yeah, two. Yeah, it's very. Yeah, if he wins two games, he's probably guaranteed to get through. Ryan Palmer, like, it's stick a pin in this tournament, really. You know what I mean? There's so many good players. Anyone can win it. It's about just trying to, most importantly, try win the first game. You know, get a good buzz going, get a good feel for the course, get some confidence up. It's a quick turnaround from last weekend as well. The guys, they didn't play last year obviously because of COVID, but most of them know the course pretty well. It's a risk and reward course. You can be quite aggressive on it. It's a decent enough group. I mean, we don't really know where John Rahm is at. Ryan Palmer is a seasoned veteran, quality player. Munoz is one on tour. So, like, there's no bad players here. They're all, everyone's capable of beating one another. It's just about trying to hold a few putts. Shane did that really well with the Players. If he can, it's match play golf. It'll go back to his kind of amateur days, and he'll feed off a lot of those fields as well. But it really is a putting week. I would say the guy who puts best is probably going to do the most damage.
And we'll get to see the new Rory McIlroy tomorrow at 10:30, and he takes on old Ian Poulter. Is that a good start, a good opponent for him to start against?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, he won't be intimidated by Poulter. If Rory plays his game, he'll beat Poulter, simple as that. But he'll be very wary. I mean, he was with Poulter and Medina. He knows exactly what Poulter's capable of. You know, if he gets the bit between his teeth. It's probably a good draw for Rory because he knows he'll have to perform. It's whether he can bet in these new changes. I don't know how many they've made so far, but I'm hoping not too many. But it's a good start for Rory. He knows he'll have to play his best stuff to beat Poulter because Poulter will be, you know, more than up for it. And as we've seen with his Ryder Cup performances, when he gets going, Poulter, he's a formidable match player.
So I tipped about 25 duds last weekend, last week even. Gary, what's your fancies for this week?
I think Abraham Answer for a bit of kind of middle of the market value. He did really well down in Australia at the President's Cup. I think that experience will be something that he can dwell on. His best buddy won on the Corn Ferry Tour last week. Small little things like that can give guys a boost. So he'd be an outsider who might upset, but Bryson's going to be fascinating as well because he's going to, you know, bring all his power. And I think it's going to be a great week. It'd be nice to see some of the favourites hanging around at the weekend. It's tricky tournament from that point of view and from a sponsor's point of view where all the stars could be gone by Friday. So that's why the format is the way it is. But it's going to be a fascinating watch, and especially Ryder Cup for the Europeans. It's huge, and hopefully Shane Lowry can take a few scalps and have a big week.
Thanks a million, Gary Murphy. We hope he does too. We're going to take a break.
With Green Firm. A quick and easy addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry, or snack. Natural protein, your way.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back now. With the Olympics and the Paralympics looming, I think it's safe enough to start looking ahead to them. I'm delighted to say that we are joined by paracyclist Martin Gordon and his pilot Eamon Byrne to chat about the Next Level campaign. Martin, how are you? We had you on only a little while ago when we were trying to figure out whether the Olympics and the Paralympics would go ahead. We do seem to be edging closer anyway, and it's definitely a positive thing to be talking about the Next Level campaign, which hopes to raise funds for the Paralympic athletes. Can you just tell us a little bit about it, please?
Absolutely, yeah. No, I think first of all, it's great that we're speaking about the games going ahead now that we're confident these games are going to happen, and that it's just something for us as athletes, but also for spectators to really get excited about this summer. But the Next Level campaign, what is it about? It's really become about because there's a funding gap there that has come about because of the COVID pandemic. So what happens now is we need the public to get behind the Paralympic movement, so the infrastructure on the ground for us to facilitate the athletes on the ground in Tokyo to perform. It's a lot harder now because of COVID. All the restrictions that are going to be put in place, all the extra infrastructure that's needed, that needs to go into place so that the athletes can perform at their very best. But also with the Next Level campaign, it's not just about Tokyo, it's also about Paris 24, it's about Paris 28, it's about tapping into so much talent that's there in Parasport in Ireland to get people involved, but also that infrastructure that we have today can grow and can be there to develop more athletes for those games and to prepare athletes who are already in the program to be ready for those games as well. So it's not just for this summer, but it's right through the next two campaigns.
It sounds like a very wise move, all right, to safeguard the future, because I think, if anything, we've learned over the last year that the strangest things can happen. Eamon, just in terms of looking ahead to the Olympics, where are you guys in terms of qualification?
So at the moment, actually, we're in Mallorca and we have a trial on Saturday, which will give us a fair idea what it looks like for us in June when we're officially the selections will be announced. We're confident, we're quietly confident that we'll be able to perform and put in a good performance, but inevitably mid-June is when we find out if we're going or not.
So Martin, what does the trial entail now over the weekend? What are you going to have to do?
What we're going to do is We're going to be given an opportunity to lay down a time in our event on Saturday in conditions that will closely as possible replicate those conditions that we would have at an international race event. So that is the opportunity we'll be given to fulfill that domestic selection criteria to get one of those spots that we've already qualified as a nation for. So it's really going to be us 4 laps of the track as fast as we possibly can go. All the training that we've done for the past year is going to go into Saturday. As Eamon said, we are quite confident. A lot of work has gone into this, but it's really going to be, that trial is going to be our best opportunity to lay down our qualification standard for the Games.
Eamon, as Martin has said, a lot of work has gone into this, but you weren't on a velodrome since last February till you went to Mallorca. Has that been a revitalising experience? Have you seen it on the velodrome, the improvements you've made?
Absolutely. We've talked about it. When we first got on the track, I think it took maybe 60 seconds to just feel at home again. It was like we hadn't been off the track. The only kind of alien feeling for us is the work we put in the last year. We are almost like a new bike. We're so much stronger, so much fitter and faster. And the bike just felt just so much better than 12 months ago. But yeah, I think not having a velodrome is it's almost like the Jamaican bobsleigh team. we're pigeonholed as a tandem sprint bike with no velodrome, and we would have always had to travel to training, always had to travel to events. But look, we've made the most of it for the last year. We've gotten a lot of support with Sport Ireland. We've been able to train in the Sport Ireland Institute. And it's actually really showing at the moment, so we're happy out.
And Martin, you often hear people saying they put trust in their teammates and trust in everybody around them, but your trust in Eamon's is even more than anybody else's. I mean, he basically is the eyes. He must be like your guardian angel.
He is, but there's as much I can do on the back of that bike to cause quite
you're the power. Fully understand that without doubt.
It's equal effort, but if I jerk on those handlebars, it's a one way trip to the deck. But when you're coming down off a banking at over 70 kilometres an hour, that steering is definitely in Eamon's control, for sure it is. But it's a mutual trust, because we both have to be absolutely bang on in what we're doing, because an awful lot can go wrong very quickly, very easily. Because remember, we race on a bike on a velodrome that has no brakes, so there's no just pulling the brakes on this bike. You come to a gradual slowdown, so if something goes wrong, you can't just rectify it quickly. So it's the trust has to be there for both of us all of the time. But we race together. You put the trust in your teammates, whether you're, packing down in the scrum, whether you're on a tandem, you're trusting the guys you're doing the job with.
Ruby's crunching up his face here, and I'm looking at him. You go on a horse. How many miles an hour? And you're reacting like that.
Yeah, but I had rain, so I hoped I had brakes. But what kind of communication do you have, guys? Eamon, do you do the communicating, or does Martin do it?
Look, we both communicate. I think there's a lot of unspoken communication when you're riding a tandem in a race kind of situation. The category that we're in, we compete against visually impaired athletes as well as blind athletes, and so sometimes the rider on the back can actually see a little bit and can pick the littles out themselves. We don't have that benefit, and there's a lot of whispering goes on, but there's a lot of intuition there, and we are able to kind of feel each other's movements out. Martin will know when it's time to go, because we're connected at the same chain. And we've never been caught out communication wise, put it that way. And I think the same with training. We're constantly working together and constantly trying to get better, but if we don't communicate effectively, we're never going to get faster, you know.
Well, we'd be hoping the communication is all well done at the end of this weekend, lads. Thanks a million. Tara Sheard is up next. That's all we have time for.